What she's trying to do in that book is to show how the poor were moralized. Poverty wasn't just viewed as an inevitable human condition or something that, you know, if you were poor, that you deserved to be so forever, that there was something about you intrinsically that condemned you to poverty.
Welcome to Acton Line, a product of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Eric Cohn, executive producer. Gertrude Himmelfarb was one of the foremost historians of Victorian life. She produced page-turning biographies of some of the age's most intriguing and influential figures, including Lord Acton, Charles Darwin, John Stuart Mill, and George Eliot. She also produced social histories of the period and brought a Victorian sensibility to American politics as a leading conservative public intellectual. In this episode, Acton's librarian and research associate Dan Huger speaks with Nicole Penn, author of an essay just published in National Affairs entitled The Historian's Craft, which deftly explores the life and legacy of one of the conservative movement's most accomplished women. You can find additional resources in the show notes for this episode, as well as find previous episodes of Acton Line on our website at acton.org/actonline. And if you like this program, you can help us reach even more listeners by sharing it with a friend and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We welcome your comments as well. Acton Line is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Welcome. My name is Dan Huger, librarian and research associate at the Acton Institute. Today I am joined by Nicole Penn, senior program manager at the American Enterprise Institute. She is also a doctoral student in history at George Mason University. She's also a former research assistant to Lynn Cheney. Today we'll be discussing her essay in the latest edition of National Affairs, The Historian's Craft. It's a delightful and thought-provoking essay which examines the nature of history and the historian's vocation through the life and work of American historian Gertrude Himmelfarb. Nicole, welcome to Acton Line, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Gertrude Himmelfarb was an extraordinary and accomplished woman, both as a historian and as a public intellectual, but also very underappreciated by too many historians today and forgotten by too many public intellectuals today, I think. As a young scholar, where did you first encounter Himmelfarb, and what sort of impression did she make on you?
So that's a great question. I met Gertrude Himmelfarb when I was a research assistant at AEI back in 2018. She was attending an event that we were hosting with Leon Cass on his latest book, I think Leading Worthy Lives. And I had been asked by a senior fellow here, Carlin Bowman, if, you know, because B was in her mid-90s at this point, if I'd be willing to accompany her home after the program was over, just to be in the Uber with her and to make sure that she got home safely. So I had known about B's work. I knew that she was a historian, and that was something that really piqued my interest because when I started working as a research assistant for Lynn, I had a master's in history. I was trained as a historian. I was working with Dr. Cheney on this history of the Virginia dynasty. And I was, you know, being exposed to this world of, you know, female historians that are working in the conservative intellectual space. So I just jumped at the chance when Carlin asked me to take her home. And so, you know, the event ends, we pack her into the Uber, and it was so cold. It was such a cold night, I remember. And she was so, she struck me as so frail in some ways, but the minute we got into the Uber, and this was totally coincidental, I just happened to be reading Middlemarch.
And she wonderful.
She sees a copy of Middlemarch in my bag, and we have this lovely conversation about Middlemarch, and especially about Fred Vincey and Mary Garth and their relationship, which tends to be, I think, under discussed as part of like the interweaving and complicated plots that are happening in Middlemarch. and really pulling out what Elliot is trying to say through their relationship. And that conversation, she was so lucid and so bright and lovely. And then, you know, the Uber ride is over. I see her into her apartment at the Watergate. And before she leaves, she says, she didn't say this to me. She emailed me the next day and said, I wanted to thank you for accompanying me home, escorting me home last night. I have a couple books for you. If you want to come back to the Watergate, you can pick them up at the front desk. So I marched my way over and I have two signed copies. And the two books that she gave me were The Moral Imagination and Roads to Modernity. And so I just felt like that was really fortuitous, and they're just such wonderful books. And especially after I read, I mean, The Moral Imagination is just this gem of a book. It's her going through I think it's really the people and the thinkers, the intellectuals that have resonated with her the most. It's a kind of like capstone piece in some ways, where she explores, it's a collection of essays on different intellectuals. She has a great chapter on George Eliot. And Middlemarch, but Roads to Modernity really had me thinking about how she conceives of history and the connection between the historian and public conversations. And so I kind of was just like, you know, thinking about that more and more over the years. And I finally just decided to write something out of it and to delve into her work as a historian.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And it's Middlemarch is just a great meeting point for Gertrude Himmelfarb. And it's actually also a great intersection that Gertrude Himmelfarb and Lord Acton have, because Eliot is one of Acton's favorite novelists. And of course, she wrote a very famous biography of Lord Acton, Lord Acton, A Study in Conscience and Politics. But getting back to this historian's craft, you begin your essay by discussing the sort of training that historians typically receive today. What does that training look like, and how is it different from the sort of training that Himmelfarb herself received at the University of Chicago as a student in the 1940s? Because I think that's like sort of the contrast you open up with your essay in, and I think that's very illuminating. And I think it's a great nugget to open this exploration with.
Yeah, that's another great question. So the kind of, you know, introductory course that you will get when you are starting a graduate program, whether as a master's student or a doctoral student, is this, it's usually called the historian's craft. And it's a class that's really by historiography. It's zooming out and looking at the various trends in the field and how different historians have developed new methodologies, new theories. It's the history of history. And what doesn't typically accompany something like this, at least not in my experience, is a class along the lines of what Gertrude Himmelfarb describes in the opening to The New History and the Old, this work that she published, where she kind of starts to dig into the various methodological turns that are happening in the academy. And in this other class, she really was trained in the art of digging through sources and, you know, figuring out how to interpret sources, why sources matter. So she was given assignments like, you know, figuring out the time of day at which the sun rose on a particular day of the French Revolution. She admits in her essay, she's like, I don't really remember what the significance of this was, but I remember that it was significant. And it's this very, you know, material experience that she has. And the other key assignment that she gets, which is something that I myself experienced, but not in the context of the classroom, was she was tasked with fact-checking a piece of scholarship and going through all the footnotes, proving that they exist, proving that they were cited correctly, proving that they were interpreted correctly, that any claims that were made in a paragraph were supported by the evidence that the historian is sourcing. And that is such an invaluable, I cannot express how invaluable that kind of training is. And I got that training myself, not in the classroom when I was at William & Mary. I got it as an editorial apprentice at the Omohundro Institute, which is a very leading and important scholarly publication coming out of William & Mary. They focus on early American studies. And as an editorial apprentice, I had to go through the same thing. What the OI does is they go through, when they receive a manuscript, they go through a very rigorous fact-checking process that is run by these editorial apprentice. And And that was the skill set that I was able to bring when I was hired at AEI in 2016 as a research assistant for Lynn Cheney, because she wanted me to do the exact same thing, is to go through her manuscript, check footnotes, make sure that any claims she was making were backed up by evidence. And these are the building blocks of the profession. So it's kind of, it was just interesting to me to realize that, yes, I had cultivated these skills, but that was not something that I experienced in the classroom in the same structured way that it seems that B. Himmelfarb had been expected to do.
This resonates so much with my experience. I mean, I remember taking a historiography class, and we'd read things like Nietzsche's On the Advantages and Disadvantages of History for Life. And those are like very interesting and very helpful. But yeah, where I actually picked up the sort of nuts and bolts stuff was later editorial work for Acton. You know, we reissued a book by Lester DeCoster called Communism and the Christian Faith that he wrote for this sort of introductory series for Erdman's Publishing. And as a result, he has all these direct quotes but no footnotes. But we at Acton had inherited his library of some 10,000 volumes. So I'm digging through all these Soviet-era Marxist-published texts and tracking that down. And that was really fun and really really enjoyable and really valuable, but it's not what I received in my history education. And it's very much, this is also, Gertrude Himmelfarb in her biography of Acton talks about Acton's formation as a historian with his teacher Dullinger and going to archives and actually sifting through documentation and knowing that, reading your piece brought this all back to me and how much this must have resonated with her as she was writing that book. You make a very astute observation that Himmelfarb was a historian of ideas, yet she was a historian first. And part of that is the sort of nuts and bolts work we were just talking about. But it's bigger than that. For listeners who aren't historians, could you sort of orient them to what it is as a historian of what is a historian of ideas? And what traps are very, very easy for historians of ideas to fall into? And how does Himmelfarb negotiate that and avoid some of those traps in her own research and writing?
That's another great question. So I can tell you a little bit of the context where that line in my piece comes from. I was talking to Yuval Levin, my boss here at AEI. And I don't know how seriously he meant this, but he said something like, we were talking about B, and he said something like, well, you know, if she had been at Chicago 10 years later, she probably would have just been a political theorist. And that just kind of stuck with me. Yeah. And I was like, I'm not so sure about that. And that's another impetus for the piece, is I really wanted to take her seriously as a historian of ideas. And I think that's almost just like a professional reaction to, I work with a lot of political theorists and a lot of political scientists here at AEI, and they are wonderful. I mean, something that's really key to me, that's become clear to me, is that political theorists and historians need each other. We look at the past in different ways, but that can illuminate each other ultimately. But, you know, I think when it comes to B as a historian of ideas, I think what's important is that she takes ideas seriously, but she wants to ground them in the material space that from whence they were born. And I think what the intervention that she has and that historians of ideas have is that it's very, you know, something might seem very clear cut on paper, but once those ideas start working their ways through a society, there's a lot of tensions that they have to encounter. And even within an individual, there's a lot of tensions between what an individual writes at one point in their life and how they think about sometimes those very same ideas at a different point in their life. And that kind of evolution, I think, historians of ideas can be very sensitive to. She really said that she wanted to write her book on Acton as a way to push back against those who would try to systematize his thought in a way that she thought was inappropriate or perhaps would take away from a real grappling with him as a person. But I do think what, you know, a trap that perhaps a historian of ideas can fall into, because historians are trying to do so much, and because, you know, she focused really on a lot of biographies. She wrote these biographies of Victorian intellectuals, so she could really just concentrate on one individual at a time. As you start zooming out, the place where we need perhaps the political theorists, or we need people who can spend the time just really sitting with ideas and going through a work, an intellectual work, really carefully. Because historians are trying to rebuild, I think, an entire society from the ground up so that we can understand how ideas percolate through that society. And it's just kind of a question of time. There's only so much time that you can devote to either enterprise.
Yeah. When you mention these individual and personal tensions, and this is one of the things I love about the Acton biography. One of the things, the other early biography, she does one of Darwin that's fascinating, and she does one of John Stuart Mill. And these are all very interesting books, and they're very personal books. They're sort of warts and all presentations of these figures. And it's not to sort of, you know, glory in their weirdness or their strangeness, but it's a way of getting at really understanding and unpacking those ideas in a way that only historians can do. This isn't, you know, these people, even though they produce works that may contain syllogisms, their thought as a whole isn't always laid out like that. She makes a remark very early on in the Acton biography about how we're just now, and this is in 1952, coming to understand what Lord Acton meant. And she's very serious in this. And she, in the appendix to that biography, she goes through previous work on Acton and describes sort of why she finds it inadequate. And there's some funny stuff. She's also genuinely funny in these books. But she thinks that there's something about this sifting that even Lord Acton's own contemporaries really didn't take the time to do, that they were kind of just in awe of the man's erudition, and we're kind of like taken captive by it in some sense, in some cases, aggravated by it in other cases, but nobody really, it took a long time and someone like Himmelfarb to really wrestle through the complexities of the man and his thought. When you think of biographies, and this is, I guess, a general question, which takes us a little bit further afield from B. But a lot of folks, where they touch history is in biographies. A lot of, you know, if you run into someone in the street and you introduce yourself as a historian, and they're thrilled, and sometimes this happens, but a lot of times they're thrilled because they've read captivating biographies about historical figures that interest them. Is that, and a lot of historians are dismissive of these popular biographies, but I think there's something really too, particularly understanding ideas and navigating that through the form of the biography, that I think B really took to heart and really made the center of a lot of her life's work. Where do you think, as a historian, of the place of biography in the historian's craft?
I love biographies. I think biographies are such a useful window into a society. I mean, not just understanding, you know, an individual life, which I do think is so important. I think there is sort of a moral imperative. I mean, that's a whole other conversation perhaps we can get into, is, you know, what's the historian's relationship to morality? But I do think why I love history so much is because there's a real love of humanity that I think, you know, drives most historians, and biography is a great way to really, you know, interrogate a human life and then open a window into the world in which that life was carried out in a way that is really accessible to a lot of people. And I do think that's really important for history. I think history, it's about stories, and you should be I think historians should be careful to not just, I mean, it's important that we have conversations with each other and to really engage with each other in ways that are, you know, advancing the sum of knowledge. Those conversations are going to look a little bit different than conversations that we have perhaps with the public, but we should never forget, I think, the public audience. And I also think I reviewed a work by James Marcus. It was a biography of Ralph Waldo Emerson recently. And something that came through in his biography, and he's not quite, I'm not sure he's formally trained as a historian, but what I really enjoyed about his biography is he was very honest about how the life that he was studying had these moments of resonance with his own life. And I think that's what's happening with Bea too, and her study of Acton. Is Acton is a historian as well. And I think she was mining a lot from Acton's life to better understand herself as a historian, even if she had moments of disagreement. I mean, talk about sharp writing. Another reason I just want to write this piece is I want people to read Bea.
Yes.
She's a magnificent writer. She's so good. I think she's profiled in this new book that just came out by Ronnie Greenberg called Write Like a Man. And it's about the New York Jewish intellectual set from the 1960s. And I think they really, she's so sharp and she's so, you know, kind of acerbic, but in a really well-crafted way. So I want people to read her, but you know, when you read her discussing Acton, there is clearly a lot of admiration there, but it's not hagiography. That's the important part. She's really grappling with this idea. She's very honest, for example, about how in his perhaps most Burkean phase of his life, because people do change over time.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a clear example of this in some of the most Burkean stages of his life. He kind of offers this defense of the Confederacy.
Yes. And corresponds with General Lee.
And corresponds with General Lee. And she has this line where she's discussing that. And I just want to quote it because And nowhere in the letter did Acton feel it necessary to introduce the disagreeable question of slavery, just kind of like cutting, but in a very subtle way. It's very Bea. And that really made me more enamored of her because of her ability to present his life so honestly and to combine admiration with appropriate criticism.
Yeah. And this is a great uniting point because you brought up this moral question and the idea of, you know, the historian, is it appropriate for a historian to be a moralist? You have great moralist novelists like George Eliot. This is what captivates both Himmelfarb and Acton about her. But a lot of folks, you know, when I edited a single volume anthology of Lord Acton, and I was working with another historian at the time who was doing editorial work for Acton, and he asked me, you know, what do you think about this moralism? And I said, you know, I'm a big fan, and I gave my arguments, but he was a very much more conventional, you know, this is not the way that historians talk today. This is not the language of a sort of value neutral science that a lot of people like today. And Himmelfarb, with those sort of remarks, is also revealing something of her own moralism, although this is something that she thinks Acton takes too far, in fact, in his personal relationships in his life. What do you think of that interplay? Because there's interesting levels in which it's going on as Gertrude Himmelfarb is examining Acton, and she's examining these questions, but then also making these judgments as herself. Where do you think she falls on this question?
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I think we don't sometimes ask the right questions about the role of moralism in history. I kind of believe that the moralism is inevitable. I think it's impossible for us to play this completely disinterested role when we look at the past. We are shaped by our environments, our moral commitments. It's part of being human. I think it's kind of an inhuman expectation to suggest that we can just stand outside of it. But I think, on the other hand, it's difficult to be a good historian if you can't, to some degree, participate in this empathetic exercise. There was a book I was reading recently by Laurel Ulrich, Houseful of Women. It's about these female polygamists in Utah who come out in favor of women's suffrage in Utah territories in the 1870s. And the Ulrich is trying to figure out how could these women, you know, seek voting rights, but also want to use those rights to defend polygamy. But her book is this like really beautiful empathetic exercise in understanding these women. And I feel that Bee in many ways is part of that tradition in historical writing, where you can't really judge the past, you know, carefully or in a nuanced way if you don't actually like try to participate in this essential empathetic exercise. So I think I say in the piece, I think she was, and it's funny because Acton in some ways becomes more radical than Dullinger, his mentor.
Oh, yes.
Theologian Dullinger. Dullinger really thinks that there's this asymptote that you reach after a while, where, you know, truth exists, but, you know, there is an asymptote at which we can't quite, you know, really fully comprehend the truth. But Acton's just so much more uncompromising. And I think if there's one thing that I wish Bee had really grappled with, there's this fragment from the 1880s. I think it's in the Acton-Crichton correspondence that was published by Liberty Fund, where it's not, I'm not sure it's a letter. I think it's just a fragment or some notes that he wrote to himself. It's a bunch of aphorisms that Acton writes about history.
So Rufus Fears, in the third volume of that set from Liberty Fund, which is a fabulous set, the half of that third volume is just collections from unpublished notes that Fears finds at Cambridge and arranges topically. And they're wonderful. They're a goldmine.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I guess it must come from that. But Acton has this these notes, which I would have read an essay where I wish he had just written an essay on these notes. Because Acton says, advice to persons about to write history, don't. Visit the Visit the Monte Purgatorio, as Austin called the Magnesian rock that yields Epsom salt. So, and he also has this other note: the ethics of history cannot be denominational. The greatest crime is homicide. He has these very sharp. He kind of delineates his whole theory of history to me in these aphoristic notes. And on the one hand, you know, you do want to be sympathetic, and I do respect, and I think Bee respects really the fight that he is having with the Catholic Church in the 19th century, and the fight that he's having with other historians who would prefer to whitewash some of the atrocities of the Inquisition. And he's kind of an underappreciated character in this moment in religious history. But on the other hand, you know, it's, again, there's this empathetic exercise that it's interesting that Acton, as he gets older, it's very counterintuitive. As he gets older, he just becomes so much more inflexible, in his willingness to extend that to societies or individuals that violate these like core principles. So I think it's just a matter of, it's a matter of acknowledging the trade-offs, I think, in historical writing, about how you apply moralism. I think the one thing I'll just conclude just from these aphorisms that Acton has, with the last one he has, is history deals with life, religion with death, much of its work and spirit escapes our ken. And I think that's just... That's like that moment of intellectual humility. I think that's where, you know, Bee's careful moralism, especially in the, you know, between the 1960s to the 1990s, it's about recognizing this, the fact that we don't, even in our own morals, you know, we are imperfect people, and we have to have some intellectual humility about that.
Yeah, there's a line in Acton's inaugural lecture at Cambridge that he delivers very late in his life as he becomes more rigid about these things. There's no question about that. In which he quotes the, I think it's the Duc de Beauville, And he says that, you know, you have to be careful that too much explaining doesn't lead to too much excusing. And he really thinks, and this is in that famous Acton Creighton correspondence, this begins with a hostile review that Acton gives to a book that Creighton publishes, in which he excoriates Creighton for not making these sorts of moral judgments that he thinks should be made. Creighton responds in the most generous way possible, and they become fast friends after it. But it's really, you know, Creighton makes the first friendly move in that exchange, and it's fascinating to see. One of the things that I was thinking about in preparation for this conversation, and I was actually thinking about it as I was going through your piece, is in the very early days of the Acton Institute, Gertrude Himmelfarb wrote an essay for one of our publications on the deserving and undeserving poor as a category, as categories, which is kind of an outworking of a work that you examine very closely in your piece on the idea of poverty. This is Himmelfarb in a much different mode than as a biographer, and that sort of material history that we were talking about earlier that she brings to the table, that's more foregrounded in this work. What about that work is fascinating to you, and what do you think its contribution is there?
Yeah, so there was a reason I picked the books that I picked to, offer up this, what I hoped was a useful introduction to her thought and her work as a historian, because a lot of folks talk about the demoralization of society, and she was really prolific in the 1990s. But I was fascinated by the idea of poverty because it's not just a biography of an individual; it's it's a social history of an idea. And she's pulling not just from these key figures, Thomas Malthus, Adam Smith, Mills, these various individuals that were starting to conceive of poverty as a problem, but she also looks at the various interstitial intellectual layers, Chartrist pamphleteers, novelists, journalists, London's laboring poor, Henry Mayhew's, I think I'm getting that right. And she's looking at this conversation that is happening about poverty. And yes, it's driven by, one thing that she's very clear is she dearly wishes that she had the direct testimony from the poor themselves of what the, how they thought about their own, condition. But it's just, it's hard to find those sources. So she, and I think this is a really important point that she makes. And this actually, I'm not sure that she makes this point in Idea of Poverty, but she makes it in The New History and the Old, that to say that politics is just the purview of the elite is a very condescending understanding of politics, because it refuses to acknowledge the possibility that the poor or working classes would not have, that politics somehow didn't involve them or didn't impact their lives or didn't shape their lives. So she's, the Idea of Poverty takes this social history of ideas, which I think is still a pretty useful and prominent thread in intellectual history. I think it's in some ways the best marriage of intellectual history with the kind of material work that historians can do. And she makes this really compelling point that, it's not inevitable that poverty would have been conceived as a problem. But that it does in the 19th century is just this like really remarkable sign of the influence of turns in British thought that really emphasize the universality of the moral sense and the responsibility that we have to each other as equal human beings that have this capacity for the moral sense. And then, of course, you do get into these complications. And even she admits that, Victorian solutions to the problem of poverty were not always adequate to the scale of the problem. And there is this tension between the deserving and undeserving poor. But I think what she's trying to do in that book is to show how the poor were moralized, and they weren't just viewed, poverty wasn't just viewed as inevitable human condition or something that, that, you know, if you were poor, that you deserved to be so forever, that there was something about you intrinsically that condemned you to poverty.
Yeah. And it's fascinating the way she digs into those sources. All of these things that we sort of take for granted today in our politics, in our conversations about social life, are things that have their own history. And B sort of really digs in and sifts through that in an illuminating way. One of the tensions you point out in your essay, and you pointed out in a couple different places, but particularly in your treatment of the new history and the old, is her role in sort of explaining history to the American conservative movement that, you know, has sometimes a complicated relationship to history. And sort of she's doing that on the one hand. On the other hand, she's also sort of explaining to historians what the conservative movement is throughout her career. How do you view that hinge in her life as public intellectual and historian? Because she never really takes off one hat and puts on another. There's really a lively interplay of both throughout her career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the other things that that fascinates me about her is that she, you know, she retained the identity of as historian throughout her life. And yes, she has a lot of frustrations with, you know, social history, with quanto history, with psycho history, with a lot of these methodological innovations that dominate the 1980s and 90s, gender, race, class. She has her qualms with those frameworks. But on the other hand, I think she's so formed by the profession, and part of her must love it, even though she sometimes talks about it in these very disparaging terms. She says she has a professional deformation.
That's great.
I have a professional deformation as a historian, where I'm like, "Bee, no, history is wonderful," but that philosophers can see, you know, the underlying verities of history, that political theorists and political scientists can see the frameworks within which history works itself out, but historians can only see the ineluctable facts of history, which I love, because ineluctable is a word for, you know, unavoidable. Like, these are these things you have to grapple with. And I think, you know, when she's talking to conservatives, I think what she wants to make sure is that, you know, if conservatism is about preserving something about the past, she wants to ensure that conservatives are taking the past seriously. And part of what my essay, what I was trying to do in highlighting her thought in this regard is, you know, like I said, I work with a lot of political theorists. I work with a lot of political scientists. I see a lot of, you know, I supervise a team of research assistants here at AEI. So I see a lot of resumes from young people coming through. And I do worry sometimes, just because I see a lot of, you know, political theory majors, political science majors, a lot of great books emphasis, and great books are wonderful. Great books, I mean, reading Little March changed my life. I won't discount that, but great books don't just appear, you know, out of thin air. They are grounded. They are the product of a mind that's encased in a body, that's encased in a society. And I just think that her charge to historians, to conservatives, about taking the ineluctable facts of history seriously, I think is a really important point to emphasize, because the past is complicated. And if there's a tradition that's worth preserving, it's important to understand how that, you know, how that tradition has developed over time, and what were the positive and negative implications of that tradition.
Yeah, there's a critical spirit there that is so often absent in the conservative movement. I think to its detriment. I was reminded when I was when I was reading through this line of professional deformation, there's a great podcast by Amit Varma called The Seen and the Unseen. It's mostly about India, and he was discussing with a great biography, Vinay Sidipati. I forget if it was his book. He did a biography of Prime Minister Rao. He also did a book that's sort of the history of the BJP before Modi. But he's very careful in that conversation to say that he's a journalist and a political science and not a historian. And then he goes on this long discursus about how historians take these ideological methods and then they sift through the data with those methods. And he's like, you know, and I'm just interested in sort of cause and effect. I'm just laughing because this is something that would sound ridiculous to somebody who's not exposed to this world of history. Of course, you know, what do you mean that historians are trying to figure out what happened and why? But it can sort of seize hold of people like that, and it shaped the discipline in ways that are very mixed, like history's assessments itself. Now, one of the things when we talk about Gertrude Himmelfarb and her role in history, we haven't brought up her husband yet. It was Irving Kristol, who has very distinguished contributions in his own life as sort of the founder of what people call neoconservatism. Now, today, people say neoconservatism and they mean all sorts of things. And I think there is perhaps no aspect of the conservative movement that is more misunderstood today than neoconservatism. And Gertrude Himmelfarb is at the center of this particular strain of conservatism her whole life, through both her own work and her connections with her husband's work. How does Gertrude Himmelfarb fit into that neoconservatism? And how is her conservatism different in its emphasis or in its tenor than the broader conservative movement that's taking shape during her life through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s?
Yeah. You know, she and Irving were part of what Daniel Bell called the best marriage of their generation. And it was not just, a reflection of, you know, how much they truly were soulmates, but they were intellectual soulmates and they learned from each other. But I almost wonder if, and I maybe Irving himself would have admitted this, that she just really played a formative role in his thought. And Irving was... He was, you know, a journalist, and he was engaged in the debates, like really actively engaged in the public policy debates of the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. Whereas, you know, B was, I think, up until the 90s, when she starts writing much more as a public intellectual, she really still is a historian. She's working in the academy, and she's writing these histories of these Victorian intellectuals. She's engaging with debates within the academy. So, and I think with neoconservatism, a very common I don't know if it's like a misconception, but it's a mistaken emphasis, is that neoconservatism is just this... this approach to foreign policy, when it really is, you know, a way of thinking about conservatism that takes into significant account domestic policy and how we think about civil society, and the acknowledgement that that, you know, there is such a thing, you know, societies do need to change, they need to evolve, but it's about a tempered, responsible evolution that doesn't lose sight of developments in tradition or an established tradition that has elements that are very much worth preserving. And I think by taking the past seriously, Himmelfarb, and by looking at how this community in the past, the Victorians grappled with, and you know, in the long scheme of things, we are not that divorced from the Victorians. Only a couple centuries separate us from them. And in many ways, the problems that they grappled with were similar, I think, similar, but not, you know, history does not repeat itself. It rhymes. I definitely endorse that. And I think B would too, but that the gulf separating her society from Victorian society was not so large that there weren't things that that you couldn't learn by looking at how they answered these questions of, you know, how do you support the indigent, the poor, without miring them in a destructive cycle of poverty? And how do you even conceive and define poverty in the first place? You know, why is it something that, a combination of voluntary societies and the state has a responsibility to ameliorate? And I think by taking the past seriously, she introduced the answers that were given by the Victorians into the contemporary debates that her husband and the circle of intellectuals that she was a part of were engaged in the late 20th century.
I think that's wonderful. There's a heart to this. I think that Yuval Levin wrote a piece actually for Religion and Liberty, which is Acton's quarterly magazine, a while ago. Great piece on Gertrude Himmelfarb, and he entitled it, you know, Historian of the Liberal Paradox. And he takes this great section this great quotation from Gertrude Himmelfarb's biography of John Stuart Mill that he says is basically the most concise form she puts this paradox into, and she as she wrestled with it throughout her career. And I'll just quote that passage now. Having made an absolute of liberty and having established the individual as sovereign, the liberal has no integrated view of the individual in society, which can moderate either his passion for liberty or his desire for regulation and control. When liberty proves inadequate, government rushes in. And since the only function assigned to government by the principle of liberty is the negative one of protection against injury, when government is obliged to assume a positive role, neither its proper powers nor its proper limits have been defined. The paradox is inevitable. Government tends to become unlimited when liberty itself is thought to be unlimited. The paradox brings others in its wake. While contemporary liberalism has enormously enhanced the roles of society, government, and the state, it has provided them with no principles of legitimacy. And I think that it's so striking to me because it's so very similar. I mean, I see why she's drawn to Acton when she is drawn to this. Acton, very famously, he has a piece called The Roman Question in which he sort of – when I saw that, I thought immediately of this when Acton says, there is a wide divergence and irreconcilable disagreement between the political notions of the modern world and that which is essentially the system of the Catholic Church. It manifests itself particularly in their contradictory views of liberty and the functions of the civil power. The Catholic notion, defining liberty not as the power of doing what we like, but as the right of being able to do what we ought, denies that the general interests can supersede individual rights. It condemns, therefore, the theory of the ancient as well as the modern state. Thinking through this paradox is a lot of what's going on in the American conservative movement today. There are a lot of people that see the conservative movement as historically too individualist, and they think that this is that the problems they see in the world today are due to this, and they've come up with more or less sophisticated ways of dealing with that problem. What do you think the way that Bea wrestled with this throughout her life, how do you think that's instructive to this thinking through that's going on within the American conservative movement today?
Oof, what a question.
Yeah.
I think if I can offer, what might be an unsatisfactory answer, but I'm going to do my best. I mean, I think what she does really appreciate in Acton's thought, and I myself, you know, maybe you can answer this more, you know, whether, because Acton does treat liberty as a virtue and not just a vehicle for virtue, but I think he does so because it is in liberty that we can best, you know, grapple or find our way to a theory of the good or a theory of the good life. And he's very skeptical of power. I mean, you've got the famous aphorism, you know, all power corrupts. And so I think what B is navigating as she studies the Victorians, as she thinks through the American, British, French enlightenments, in her book, The Roads of Modernity, maybe that's a good place to bring this, is that a community that can allow associational life to flourish while acknowledging that as modernity creates material conditions that become more complicated, you know, requires, you know, a cooperation between voluntary associations and with established governments, you know, that one cannot lose sight, I think, of the other, but one cannot put their faith entirely in the state, especially when the state, as she knew, as a woman who lived through the 20th century, the state can be mobilized for atrocious ends. Acton saw that in the form of the Catholic Inquisition. And I think maybe something that I really do appreciate in her thought as a historian is the attention she pays to religion, to Methodism, mm-hmm. which is just this incredible movement that this religious movement that really shapes both the British, both Great Britain and the United States. I mean, Methodism is a very powerful and important, it's a religion of the heart. It's a very democratized religion, and it's responsible for a lot of voluntary associations that develop in the United States. I sometimes wonder if B gives that development a little bit too much short shrift because she's concentrating on the British. So I think that's really the heart of the paradox, but it's a paradox that in some ways is self-sustaining. I mean, you need liberty to create the space for people to choose to work with one another and to find common ground and common meaning. It can't be imposed from above through the threat of state violence. And religion often is an indispensable ally in facilitating that, that associational life. But that also means you have to give people the space, you know, in civil society to choose not to find different routes to the good life that might run counter to prevailing trends.
So I think, I mean, this is a wonderful place to end because she's not only a historian of the liberal paradox, but she is also someone who holds those tensions. She holds those tensions between public intellectual historians. She holds those tensions between freedom and responsibility. And she does it, she did it through her whole life with just an immense grace. I'm so thrilled that when we opened, you had this wonderful story about B, because I have only one wonderful story about B. And when I was working on an anthology, I had put together a little introduction for it, and I thought, you know what would be wonderful? It would be wonderful, and this is in 2017, so this is 2 years before B's passing. I go, it'd be wonderful if I could get her to write a foreword. So I write her, and I say, I talk about how deeply I admire her work. I send her what I'm going to do, the introduction that I've written, and she replies to me, which is the most kind and generous brush off I've ever gotten in my life, which is that I can't think, you know, I couldn't think what to add to your already very fine introduction. And I had it printed up and like pinned it to my cubicle for years afterwards. And she was such a kind and gracious woman. Throughout her life, we did an interview with Yuval Levin not too long after her passing, in which he shared many of the memories he had of her. And it's wonderful It's wonderful, the intellectual legacy that she had, but it's also wonderful to hear these stories of personal interactions with her. And thank you so much for sharing your appreciation of her on both of those levels with us today. This has been a wonderful conversation. We'll link to your essay in the show notes. There's a lot in that essay we weren't able to get to today, and it's really wonderful. And thank you so much, Nicole, for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. I'm not surprised that you had such a lovely encounter with Bee, even if it was just through writing. She was a really generous, she was, I think, a teacher just in every instance of her life. And thank you for having me.
As always, thank you for listening. Our team loves putting this podcast together for you. It's encouraging to hear from our listeners. Feedback is incredibly important to us because it lets us know what you'd like to hear more of, including the kinds of topics you're interested in most. If you have comments, feedback, or ideas for a show topic or interesting guest, you can email our team at producer@acton.org. Until next week, for ActonLine, I'm Eric Cohn.